is David. I was born in the outer western suburbs of Sydney. When I was about 8 or 9, my parents split up, and in that process I moved around quite a bit with my mum, going to different places, and after I grew up and became a teenager, I was very interested in spiritual things from the age of about 13, and I guess my path kind of started there on a spiritual track. And also my relationships with other people developed quite early as well. And I guess I was kind of looking for something but not really knowing what it was. And it was kind of like running without kind of seeing as things going on around you. It's like you're running after something, but what? You don't know, you don't really know, you don't really understand why either. And so after a while I kind of, when I was in a few relationships, I was kind of seeking that kind of external happiness in another person to try and fulfill myself by finding that kind of happiness. But after a few times I was let down quite badly, which led to quite a lot of suffering in my life because of that. And I got to the stage where I just didn't want to go through that anymore, and kind of led to a sense of Buddhist term we say nibbida, but I wouldn't use the word disgust. It was not that kind of sense, but a kind of like a turning away. Instead, I would use a turning away from that, because I knew that, kind of felt that wasn't going to lead me to happiness, because I experienced it and realized its results, that it always ended in sadness, and trying to find that kind of happiness. So a lot of people think that monks, or people want to become a monk or nun because they want to run away from relationships. So I guess in my case you could say that is true. But with my spiritual journey, I was interested in spiritual things from about the age of 13, and I didn't really find something that fulfilled me in that area. And I guess it was when I came across Buddhism that things made more sense. But before I became a Buddhist, I did a few different things. I was a vegetarian before I was a Buddhist, and I believed in reincarnation before I was a Buddhist. So when I came to Buddhism, it kind of made things a bit more clearer, made more sense, how kind of rebirth worked. Kind of clearer. And I guess the thing that hit home for me was the Four Noble Truths, because I had a lot of suffering, and I guess it just really touched something that inside me that was some kind of hope that it's possible to end that suffering. And it's kind of like, with my searching, it's kind of like a puzzle. You have all the puzzles except for one piece. And you've been looking for the piece, but you haven't found the piece. But then, I guess when I discovered the Four Noble Truths, it's kind of like that piece went into place. And it's kind of like, that's what I've been looking for. And so from the age of 16, that's pretty much straight away I decided I wanted to take on monastic life, and so I started my search. But backtracking a little bit, I did Welsh singing for a while. I did music for a little while. I did recorder, and I also played the Celtic folk harp and was learning Welsh as well. And so I used to do that every Friday. I used to go to Newcastle to learn. So it's about 3 hours of train from Newcastle to learn. But I left that behind when I went to ordain just before then. And before I ordained, I kind of became a bit more simple. I lost, kind of was going in a different direction than my old circle of friends. And I was quite different to them then, and so I wasn't really interested in the way they were going. And I guess then after a while, I was interested in Mahayana Buddhism, and I wanted to ordain the Chinese tradition, but in my experience of trying to find a place to go, it was very difficult. I called a lot of places in Australia trying to find a place where they could speak English. Didn't hang up the phone when I spoke to them in English. And I didn't finally find a place. But I left there after about 7 months. I visited Santa before that, and I guess I came back to Santa, and I've been there since the age of 17, now 20. I ordained as a novice when I was 18. I was a novice for about maybe a year and a half, and I took my full ordination just this year in July. So that's my little introduction to my life. And so I guess now Ayaja Guria can do her introduction.
I'm from Malaysia. I arrived at Santi 4 months ago, joined their rain retreat for 3 months, and continue to stay on. Introduction about myself, that is a bit funny in front of the camera. Maybe just a little bit. Going to 32 years old. And I joined the monastic community about two years ago. Before coming here, I was in Amarachi in England for a year and a half. 1 year as Anagarika. After that, I end my 1 year training as Anagarika, and then I came back to Malaysia and I made my way to come to Santi because of the inspiration of Pantea Suchato to re-establish the Bhikkhuni order in the forest tradition. So being inspired by his mission, I wish to be part of that, you know. And for the benefit of many others too. And life as a nun in this monastic form for myself is pretty natural, which might seem strange for many others, but for myself really I feel this is just what I want to do in this life. And I feel so much joy, you know, living as a nun. And follow the teaching of the Buddha. That you can really experience what the Buddha has taught to us and has been carried down generations by generations, and until today we can really see for ourselves what the freedom, the relief of the heart in the Buddha teaching. So yeah, that's enough for me. Maybe members of the floor, if you have any questions, you may ask.
Maybe I'll ask the first question. Were you like a Buddhist back home in Malaysia as well?
Pardon?
You're a Buddhist from Malaysia, from birth?
I'm from a traditional Chinese family, so they are not really practicing the Dharma, just kind of worshipping the Buddha. The time I really came across and start to practice is when I was at the age of 18 in my university. We have Buddhist society, so I joined the Buddhist society and joined many retreats with different teachers. From there I start my path. Very little influence from my family actually, but now I'm influenced them, which is very good.
So would that be more Mahayana oriented, this sort of Chinese, traditional Chinese background? Probably you'd be more Mahayana than Theravada.
Yeah, the ritual, you can say. You can different that from the form and ritual, but the essence is the same. The core teaching is the same. No. She was very upset when I first said to her that. But I slowly introduced her to Buddhism 1 year before I left my home, so I get my family prepared on what I'm going to do. So they know that I'm an adult and I can responsible for myself. So slowly she has to let go because I'm really know what I'm going to do and what I want to do. So my parents give me that freedom.
Was it difficult for you because your mom, how about your dad? I mean, because your parents your mom's quite upset.
Not quite a problem for myself because I have five siblings. I'm the number three, so they still have another five. So it's not such a great loss, maybe for number capacity, because he is the youngest in the family.
I have one brother and one sister, and my sister has five children, and my brother has two, so my mom has a lot of people she can worry about.
Did you have like yourself doubted sometime, like whether you want to actually go with this or?
Yeah, of course you have doubts, but I guess we usually have doubts when we have a lack of contentment. Usually when something is not being fulfilled, and when things are being fulfilled, then you look for other alternatives, and that's when our mind starts to go out. And then we have to, if we have enough wisdom, then we have to look at ourselves and see why, what is not being fulfilled, and then try to address that. Because usually if you reflect, then if you say, well, what am I going back to? Or you can also ask, how far have I come? And do you want to pick up that which you've already put down? How far you've already come? It's like walking part of the journey, and along your way, before you started out with a lot of suitcases and all the extra junk you didn't need, as you do when you travel overseas. And then on your long journey, you finally discover, why do I need a hairdryer in my journey? Or why do I need this, or why do I need that? And you chuck it all out the window. But then, I guess, if you have that lack of contentment with what you have, or what you're experiencing, then you start to try and go back and try and find those things, but actually they become a burden. So, but a lot of times the doubts can be strong, but I think we have to learn to be a friend for ourselves. And like when we develop metta for ourselves. So when we develop compassion, we should develop compassion for ourselves first. And the same with mudita, or rejoicing, or gratitude. If you have gratitude in our own good qualities, sometimes we're too hard on ourselves. And think that, oh, I can't do this, or I'm not good enough. That's the guilt coming in. And but sometimes we're too hard on ourselves when actually we've come a long way.
Before you become a monastic, do you think in your experience for yourself and amongst your companions, are you aware that it's really hopeless if you haven't got to? I mean, is it worth even thinking about it if you haven't really developed great, wonderful things happening in your meditation?
I guess, like I said, you have to look how far we've come. Maybe you've come a long way and you haven't realised it. And so maybe that's a doubt. You think, my meditation is not so good, or so on and so forth. It's kind of like an apple rotting at the core. It's kind of instead of looking forward at what's possible, we look at what seems to be impossible and what seems to be wrong now. But the inevitability of it all is that we do grow, and that depends if we want to grow or if we direct our mind in that direction. So yes, a bad meditation in the long run, as a monastic, if you have been a monastic for a long time and your monastic and your meditation hasn't developed, then this can lead to a person disrobing because of that. But still, it's very sad because I think we're just too hard on ourselves, and that's why people end up leaving a monastic life or not having contentment because they're not happy with themselves. But I guess when you, in an idealistic sense, when we come to a monastery, we want our meditation to go better. And so when you're in an environment that is supportive, then those kinds of things grow. It's like if you have a child and they're growing up around gangsters, then that their mind inclines in that way. So in the same way, what kind of environment we're in, it kind of influences our mind, and that's why spiritual companionship is very important. So if you're in a monastery where there are a lot of people who have dedicated their lives to go in that direction, then it's much easier. And also, if you have problems or questions, then there are usually always people around you can ask without having long gaps. It's kind of like it brings starvation. It's kind of like you have a kind of like a spiritual hit, but then you have a you kind of have a spiritual starvation where you have big gaps between the next kind of hit and that kind of thing. So whereas it can be a bit more sustained, but the work also has to come. Work mostly comes internally. People can only support us, people can only show us the way that we have to do it. So I think don't worry about how our meditation is going. Just see what is possible.
For myself, I see that you come in into monastic life is a life of letting go. It's not about attaining any kind of meditation state or to get something, you know. So it's actually you leave out the Dharma and you try to live out the Dharma if you are not. So in that monastic form, it will support you, a kind of reminder, you know, to always come back to the center. What is the purpose of this holy life? It's all about abandonment and letting go. So the life as monk or nun is a life of simplicity.
What was it about lay life that you became disinterested in or disenchanted with? Disaffected by?
Same thing. Goes to school, goes out, goes to university, has a relationship, gets married, spends most of their life earning a mortgage, paying off a mortgage, in a very stressful way, retiring, playing golf, having grandchildren, attending to grandchildren, and then dying. And it's like everyone does the same thing. And you're kind of like blind to that. You're kind of like, well, we're just kind of like lemmings going off a cliff, in a sense. But the thing that I felt I was turning away from was that the flow of the world was that in a materialistic sense, and that it was flowing that direction, but that kind of getting that plasma screen TV will make me happy, or going on my trip to Honolulu will make me happy kind of thing, just kind of didn't kind of it's kind of like it was it's flip side of the scene, or I guess I just kind of had enough, just kind of a bit it's kind of like if you drink the same tea all the time, you just get bored of it. It's just like it doesn't satisfy you anymore. It just doesn't provide what you thought it did, or what it's meant, or what people tell you it's meant to. It's kind of like you've seen the trick of it. You see the trick of it. Like you're no longer kind of fooled, but it's kind of become, for me, it kind of came from a sense of despair. It's kind of like I couldn't find that kind of happiness there, because it just kind of fell out from under me, and I had no control over my over that kind of seeking that kind of happiness. I had no control. It's like you're subject to something that was completely under control. And so, I just wanted to find, Buddhism provided that other way for me. So I guess before we ordain, we have the experience of, you know, the two extremes. One extreme is where we've had all the essential enjoyments, but then we kind of go to the other extreme of, oh, what is all that about? That was all a load of rubbish. Or you kind of think, oh, that was a waste of time. or something, and then we go to the extreme. We can go to the extreme view of pessimistic view of all of life. But over time, you kind of get closer to the middle way because you mature. I don't know if that answers your question. I had quite an interesting teenage life. So, kind of overfed myself, stuffed myself on too many lollies and fat food. But, with regards, I think we have, in a way, we. It's kind of a. We have to use, in a way, we're kind of using desire to abandon desire, in the sense that when you want to become monk, obviously that's a want, that you want to be free from suffering, but it's kind of like a, it talks about, in the sutta, it talks about this kind of person who has this kind of craving, oh, may I attain what the noble people have attained, but once their mind calms down, then they're able to attain that. So it's not, so that once they're able to let go of that kind of yearning, then that spiritual development can occur. But, you can get pretty dispassionate towards monastic life sometimes too, especially when when we want to become a monk or nun, we have ideals, and obviously we want those ideals to be fulfilled, but when those ideals are not fulfilled and we feel let down, then that's very difficult, but that comes from ourselves, not from what other people are doing. Those kind of ideals have come from ourselves, and we've projected them onto something, and then we suffer. Because we don't live in an ideal world. We at the monastery we can't meditate every second of the day. And there's mundane things that need to be done. We may not want to do them, and but they have to get done. And so we end up doing them. Either we can bring a good sense of mind to it, or we can bring a resentment to it, and that, oh, why am I doing this? I've become a monk, I've become a nun, I don't want to be doing this, why are this? It's not my own thing. It's like the story of Ajahn Sumedho in Thailand with Ajahn Chah, that he said they were doing this road work with all these big heavy rocks, and they were working and working and working, and then Ajahn Sumedho went to Ajahn Chah and said, I became a monk to meditate, why all this work? So then Ajahn Chah said in front of everyone, oh, Ajahn Sumedho, he became a monk, he wanted to meditate, so he won't do any more work, we'll just carry on with the work. He can go off and meditate, you can go off and meditate, don't worry, you just go off and meditate. So what did he do? He went off and meditate and thought, what am I doing? Couldn't handle it, it's too guilty, so of course he went out and helped.
Routine
that you have,
you're
encouraged
to
get up very early, and if so, does that, do you find that you easy practice, or would you rather, wouldn't it be, when you get better meditation, if you just lay in bed till you fell? Like, would you? For me, I'm not a morning person. I find it difficult to get out of bed. This is a problem for me. I guess I myself haven't been on any of Ajahn Brahm's retreats, but what I've heard is that he actually allows people to have that kind of rest. It's not that kind of, if you're being harsh on yourself, I must do this and so on and so forth, well, you kind of might as well join the army, because I mean, you get more discipline there externally. Has to have a natural flow, but when we do notice ourselves kind of slacking off a bit, then we need to bring ourselves into line. It's like like a simile that when you're herding cows and they're going off the track, then you need to give them a little whack to go back onto the track. But
I've been on meditation retreats where you do have to get up at 5 and then you feel really awful and you fall asleep and you wonder what's to be gained by it, you know. And yet it seems to be a common practice in Asia in Buddhist time. So there must be seen to be a benefit, but I've not been able to find what the benefit is.
Mm. Yeah, it's good to get things up early.
Do you get up at 5?
Depends. Sometimes I'm like 3, I'm like 6, 5. Because in Santi, it's up to you for the morning. As long as you turn up 7:30 for the work. We don't have morning pressure.
Mm-hmm.
So it's basically you have to be responsible for yourself. But for myself, I like to do meditation in the morning. It really fresh you up for the whole day. Even though just 10 or 20 minutes, you know. It's not meditation, just some chanting. It will really change your whole feeling of a new day. It will be a beautiful day.
Since our meditation is going very well in the evening, and so we have a very good meditation experience, so we just want to keep on meditating and thus maybe meditate for 3 hours, 4 hours. And then by the time we finish though, it's already 12 o'clock and then we need to wake up at 3 o'clock. And so then you kind of get into this kind of rigid. When you become rigid, it's kind of like a blunt saw when you're trying to cut wood. It feels that kind of bumpy kind of feeling as you're trying to cut with your life. You just kind of feel kind of... sometimes we have a flow that suits us, but the environment that we're in, that kind of flow doesn't work because of our external situation, and so that can be a bummer sometimes. But I guess always bring the approach of being kind to ourselves first, because we're always usually harsh on ourselves, and if we try and switch that and be kind to ourselves first, then if we start to play up a bit, then we can knock ourselves into line a bit. But listen to ourselves is very important. Listening to what does my body need, or what do I need at this very moment? Am I really tired and therefore I need some rest? And then you can investigate, well, why am I tired? I've been thinking over a certain subject that's brought a lot of strain. And then you can look at the cause and effect relations to thinking about this subject equals tiredness and stress, therefore try to turn around and have another way of seeing it.
From what you described earlier, it sounded like you had a strong attachment to finding happiness through other people.
Mm-hmm.
So did you struggle with, or do you still struggle with letting go of that attachment? And what did you look to any particular teachings of the Buddha that helped you let go of that attachment?
Sometimes I do struggle with that. The thing that kind of helped me to let go was this teaching of Ajahn Chah was not sure. this kind of thing, you say, not sure, not sure. So he said, if you think you're enlightened, not sure. If you think you're an arahant, that's even very much not sure. It's very not sure. So, and the sense of impermanence. I read the Four Noble Truths by Ajahn Sumedho, and I guess that helped. I guess sometimes I look for the emotional warmth, but my journey is finding that internally, trying to develop that. So that's my path, is trying to develop, I guess, like Bhante Sujata said, is that's kind of like developing yourself to realize that there wasn't one there to begin with.
In your experience of the years in monasteries, meeting with my people who have been monastics for 20 or 30 years, do you ever hear them, have you ever heard about their dispassion towards monastic life after that length of time? And do you ever hear of people continuing in monastic life because they feel they have nothing to come back to in lay life, as far as, because they never perhaps developed an occupation or something, and so therefore they feel they must stay in monastic life?
I guess in traditional Buddhist cultures, ordaining is an option for education. In some places like Thailand, or in Sri Lanka, if you're ordained, you can get free, I think you can get three universities in Sri Lanka, so ordaining is an option for education sometimes. But I've met one monk who had doubts, and he said he just keep putting them off. I heard of one monk who, after 20 years, he disrobed, or two. With two monks after 20 years, they disrobed. I guess it kind of eats you up from inside, and you can't ignore it anymore if that is really the case. If it's really the case that you don't really have any other option, therefore you say, ordained is not what you want to do.
Mm.
It's really your heart is not there, and so it's kind of like rust. It kind of eats away at the metal, and at the time it's just a little push and it all crumbles. So you can't really hide it forever in monastic life, because if you're depressed, or you don't want to be there, or you're just hanging out, then people generally know what kind of direction you're going, because they live with you and they see how you're doing, whether you're practicing or not, or whether you're doing whatever. But I think for Westerners, we're very kind of like, well, feel like a failure if I couldn't do monastic life, and therefore want to leave. But probably in Asian cultures, it would just be the norm.
Mm-hmm.
So in Thailand, a lot of monks disrobe. Have about 300,000 monks in Thailand. They ordain temporarily. But in Sri Lanka, things are very different. If you ordain, you ordain for life. And so if you disrobe, then you're seen as very shameful. It's a very shameful thing. But sometimes people have genuine reasons, like, okay, well, if monastic life didn't work, then that's fine. That's okay. You can admit that and say, okay, well, it didn't work. And so now it's time to leave, and that's okay. We're not going to hold it against someone if they want to just work. It's just unskillful.
Also, just as lay people generally, in order to survive,
yeah,
we tend to need somewhere to live and a certain amount of income.
Yeah.
And maybe when monastics are older and decide to do
need those sort of foundations that lay people generally tend to have. What sort of what do they have to fall back on then in that kind of situation?
Usually falling into a relationship with someone else. And when I've heard that people who disrobe feel that they have a lot to catch up on, and usually jump right into a relationship. And one Australian monk, he was on day for 22 years. He just wrote, I think it was last year in New Zealand. And I heard recently that in Melbourne, there's a monastery there. He had a baby. Feel that they can't go back to monastic life, and so they feel kind of devastated, I guess. It's usually always very sad, but there are people who have this role a long time to go back to work. It's like that Australian monk is called Jasper, there's a recommendation. You can't live life forever. It's like if you're in a relationship and if you have had an affair, say for instance, you can't keep that forever because it just kind of, you're living a lie and it eats you from inside, and it's just kind of very painful. And the longer you leave it, the worse it becomes. Okay, well, in Thailand and Burma, Thailand and Burma, they don't like each other. And so there's wars between Thailand and Burma. And it was suspected at that time when Thailand and Burma were at war that the Burmese spies were disguising themselves as monks. And so the Thai king thought, okay, well, in order to discover who the spies are, order all the monks to shave their eyebrows, and then once the spies return back to Burma, then they can discover who has shaven eyebrows, and therefore can find out who the spies are. So if you reflect on it, it seems a bit unwholesome that monks should be shaving their eyebrows in order that spies can be found so that they can be assassinated. So I guess at our monastery we don't share our eyebrows, because I myself think it's an unwholesome thing that has such an unwholesome history, that why do we keep on doing it? So why do
it?
Pardon?
It was a fairly recent idea.
I'm not sure how long ago, probably a couple of hundred years. But because the king is so respected in Thailand, then think that I guess that's the reason why it's kept on going.
Certain expectations from your senior monks to where you'll go now, and is that set in stone? Is that set, or can that be negotiated? You know, do you have yearly reviews and see how you go and what you'd like to achieve? And that's, is that something that you discuss with people?
Yeah.
I don't know how it works, but
life is not sure. So life as a monastic, is not sure. This is what we we need to realize, you know, instead of, because all the idea of expecting or getting somewhere is suffering at the bottom. You get something, you're happy for a while, then you're gone. So yeah.
There is a process though, isn't there, before someone can take ordination, that they have to have the agreement of all the monks present at that moment. So you could get rejected before you even get in.
Usually the order of monks and nuns works as a census based. So if one monk or nun disagrees, then it's all vetoed. Kaput, nothing works. So at my ordination, if one monk decided that he disagreed for whatever reason, then my ordination wouldn't go ahead. So if someone wants to ordain, then yes, it's possible that some monks or nuns may say, no, we don't think this person should ordain for certain reasons. Given in the Buddhist scriptures, there's certain reasons, certain people who shouldn't ordain, and so if you have certain sicknesses, tuberculosis, epilepsy, something like that, usually once the process is, if you want to become a monk or nun, then you come to the monastery, and after spending some time there, then at Stanford we have three requirements. One is a blood test. Second one is a case report. Third one is a psych test. So we don't want to make sure that we don't have child molesters or people with HIV or something join the monastery. It's possible that people with certain illnesses can join the monastery, and I certainly have stayed in a monastery where a monk had Hep B, and it was just the arrangements were made that it was possible for him to be able to live with everyone else. So usually then you become, if that goes okay, then you become what we call an anagarika, or also we would call a postulant, or one in training. And then you do that for a year, after a year, if all goes well and the monks or nuns think that you've been a good candidate and you haven't done too many things wrong. Otherwise, forgiveness. after that, then you can become a novice. After a year of novice period, then if everything goes okay, then you're given coordination. Then after coordination, you generally have to have a teacher for 5 years. So you have to, you don't have to have the same teacher, but you have to be living under a teacher. And so sometimes you do see in traditional Buddhist cultures that people just kind of have a drive through McDonald's ordination, and then they wander around here and there, they don't really have a teacher and no real training. And you can actually see that kind of quality in those people when you meet them, that you can tell what kind of, how their monastic life has been so far by the way they act. According to Vinaya standards, you should know both the monks and nuns' rules in detail, and be able to recite both of them in Pali. But not many people these days actually do that. So generally, it's what happens these days. If you can look after yourself with regards to basic meditation, and you can look after yourself with regards to the rules, that you know what is and what is not an offence, then you can look after yourself. Then after 5 years, then you're given independence. But that's not guaranteed either. So if you're a teacher, thinks that you shouldn't be given independence and they can keep your independence for the rest of your life. Depends on how good you are and how well you've got it. But it's not all concrete either. Because one of the things that Vajrasattva asked of me if I was to take ordination that I should stay there for 2 years. And that if I did want to leave, I'd have to have a very good reason. So moving around too much is not always good. It's like Ajahn Chah talks about this mangy dog. Wherever it goes, it runs under the tree, it's got mange, it scratches itself, runs in the house, it's itchy. Wherever it runs, it's always itchy. So it doesn't matter where you run, you always run, you always get the defilements with you. So you don't just stay put under the same tree for a little while first.
How much guidance do you get? And I get the impression that monks are sort of left on their own there, perhaps in that they might have a talk once a week. Is there more to it than that at Santi? Actual teaching under the teacher?
Well, at Santi we have about four times we come together a week. We have two sutta classes, a Dhamma talk and a group meditation. In the future we will be having Vinaya classes. It's just been a bit hectic. But generally we read it ourselves and we can be quite educated from that. So we can actually learn it from the book actually. We can learn from other people's experience. Okay, well what is this? Is this right or is this wrong? We can ask someone and find out. With regards to meditation, anytime you have any questions, then you can always discuss it with other monks and nuns, and you can talk with Vajrasattva. And it's one of his good qualities is that he's very open. You can talk about things with him, and I've been quite happy with the instructions I've got from my meditation. So there's always that support there. We just have to learn to be able to reach out for that support more often. Okay. One more question? Any more questions?
Yes. You talk about you can't be crazy before you go in, but I've heard recently you somebody going crazy while they were in, and felt you were right when they went in. And now they're in the management institution.
Yes, I have heard there's a monk who in Perth who has gone crazy. Yeah.
He's a venerable
Radha.
He was a great philosopher before he went in, a very wise man.
In the monks and nuns rules, there's cases where you don't fall into offences, and one of the cases is mad. So if you're mad, you can't break any of your rules. So if they're crazy or something and they're going around stealing things or whatever, it's because they're out of their mind, so it's not, it doesn't break any of their rules. But the question is, I guess it's a very complex thing, and I guess we shouldn't jump to conclusions about it. Because it's many possibilities. One thing is he could have had something there that he thought he could deal with and was trying to think that the monastery was the way to solve the problem that the monastery can't solve. Or many possibilities. It's hard to know.
It does seem that it can be the striving in itself if you strive too hard.
This is like with me. I did my knee in, and that was because I sat in meditation too long, and in the end my knee went, okay, well, that's enough. I couldn't sit on the floor for about maybe 2 months. I had to see the chiropractor for quite a while, and that's what happens. But I think that is a very big problem in monastic life, especially in male monastic life, is that we think tough is good, but tough is not good, not all the time. I mean, if you, like in Thailand, they have the rule that even if you had malaria, you still had to go on alms round. So that's the big extreme. It's kind of like going to the extreme where the Buddha said that, it, you know, the extreme of self-mortification, if you're sick, you're sick. That's just, you know, just the way it is. I think that we as Westerners already kind of have that kind of striving attitude, but I think that that Asian people more have that emotional kind of maturity, whereas maybe they need to push themselves a bit more, whereas we need to learn the emotional maturity and to back off on the pushing.
Mm-hmm.